It's now time for the Fantasy 411 podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Fantasy 411. I'm Matthew Leach, talking fantasy baseball with MLB.com's lead fantasy writer, Fred Zinke. And as we talk today, we will start with it's not really sad news, but a sad development. We just kind of want to take a minute to remember Roy Halladay, who was the favorite pitcher and favorite player of a lot of people. I was lucky enough to be there for Game 5 in 2011. That's a game he and the Phillies lost, but one of the best games I have ever seen in my life, and he was brilliant. Covered his good friend Chris Carpenter for a while. But, Fred, you watched Doc up close a lot, and curious kind of what you remember about Doc, either the pitcher or the person, because I think one of the things that's come up is that they were both pretty special.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's my big takeaway from the whole thing, and it's not a new takeaway on Roy, but it's that he was such an amazing pitcher, yet at the same time so revered as a person. And I think for someone to be so incredibly talented at something that attracts so much attention, yet remains so humble at the same time. And I got to watch him, was lucky enough to see, you know, almost all of his starts during his time with the Blue Jays, and just enjoy how competitive he was, how intense he was, but also just what a good teammate he was. And that's the first thing you hear from everyone. I mean, we can go stat by stat about what a great pitcher he was, but people talking about what a great teammate he was, what a great friend he was, and people all through the Blue Jays organization talking about it, from, you know, players to management to people who handle equipment to people who look after tickets, and how personable he was with all those people. And then from a stats perspective, obviously in fantasy, he was just remarkable. I looked up just before we were ready to start today, from 2010 to 2011, that was now obviously time with the Phillies, between the regular season and the postseason, what a workhorse he was. So in those 2 years, he threw 522 and a third innings. He won 43 games, 18 complete games. And, I mean, we're talking 2010, 2011. We're not talking about, you know, dead ball era and 70 years ago. We're talking about this decade, over a two-year stretch, 522 and a third innings. I mean, to put that in perspective, Chris Sale threw 214 and a third in the regular season this year. So, I mean, when Halladay was at his best, he was as much of a workhorse, really, as we've seen. And I know we've seen some other really talented pitchers in his generation, but his ability to just go deep into games and really not leave until the job done was done was really remarkable.
We won't dwell on this topic all day, but two things. One, you pointed out something that I always paid a lot of attention to, and particularly when I covered guys. You know, I was always really conscious of the fact that even when you cover somebody every day, you don't really know them. And one of the things that I put a lot of stock in was how players treated people who weren't other players, and not even necessarily reporters, because to some extent they needed us too, but the thing you kind of touched on, how do you treat the clubbies? How do you treat, you know, the training staff, all those kinds of people, you know, the ushers, all of that. That's something I put a lot of stock in. How do you treat people who on some level are not of the same status that you are? And the guys who are good to those people are probably good guys. And then one other thing I would like to point people to, Todd Zalecki from MLB.com had a piece that went up yesterday about Halladay's influence on young Phillies players in his role as, I forget what they called it exactly, I think it was life skills coach. But anyway, somebody who really was working with prospects on the mental side of the game, and some people talking about the influence he had there. And again, it tells you more about the person. We all knew the pitcher, but you kind of wish, I think a lot of people did know the person, but you kind of wish that some of this stuff had come out sooner. That's kind of often the way it is. Anyway, so there's no way not to make that an awkward transition, so we will just go right into talking fantasy baseball, but Roy Halladay will be missed, no doubt about that. Giancarlo Stanton is the name in the news this week. And he has already, it seems like, you know, I don't think there's enormous momentum towards getting something done this week, but it seems like the Marlins are getting some ideas as to who they want, who they will deal with. Sounds like they have an idea as to where Stan's willing to go. All the kinds of things that need to get squared away before this sort of really starts moving down the road, it seems like they're getting that stuff squared away. So there are some places that would seem great for him and some places that would not. I have some ideas. I'm curious what you think as well. Give me one place that, as a fantasy owner, you would be really excited for Stanton to go and one you would not, among the places that are getting talked about.
Yeah, well, I will say this, that if Stanton's moved this winter, I don't think it'll be a real boom for his value probably overall, because he had a really, like, beyond just his personal success last year, like, he had a really nice supporting cast on top of that lineup last season. Marcell Ozuna hit so well. Christian Yelich hit so well. You know, I believe they had four guys on the Marlins score 100 runs last year, which is really impressive. But when I was looking at potential destinations that are reasonable, like Colorado I don't think is reasonable, for example, I thought Boston as a potential would probably, from a fantasy perspective, be really advantageous from my point of view, just in the sense of the AL East is usually really offensively charged. That's a fine park to hit in. There are a lot of other fine parks to hit in that division. And then the way Boston spends money, they should have a good lineup around him, you know, basically every year. Sometimes a little better, sometimes a little worse. But overall, it's hard to see him ever end up, you know, with not a lot of talent around him in Boston. I think it's more, I've heard the Red Sox a little bit. I think I've heard the Cardinals. I've heard the Giants. I think of those three that Boston would be a much better destination, both in terms of, like, home park, but also probably his likely supporting cast on an extended basis.
I would not mind St. Louis. I think that they are going to put a pretty good offense together. I think that the point you make about Boston makes a lot of sense, which is knowing what we know now. Look, that was actually not a great offense last year, but it is unlikely to stay that way. It is likely that even if they were to find a way to bring him in, it wouldn't be all they did, and they will bolster that and find some more ways to score runs. You know, obviously, to me, the one that jumps out as would be scary is San Francisco. It is not as bad a place to hit for right-handed hitters as for left-handers, but still, it's a tough place to hit. It's going to take a lot more than one guy to turn that into the kind of lineup where you have faith in a guy in fantasy. One other one that I want to note that doesn't seem to be anywhere down the road, but you just can't imagine they're not going to get engaged. You can't imagine the Marlins aren't going to call them. You can't imagine they're not going to call is the Dodgers. It would pretty much be malpractice on the Marlins' part not to at least call the Dodgers and see if they wanted to make this interesting. And I think that would be a great fit. That is an underrated place to hit for power. It's obviously a really deep and good lineup. They have shown some ability to maintain guys who have, you know, sometimes nagging injuries, because that has been one issue for Stanton. Staying healthy has been a concern. I think, you know, I'd have trust in that training staff to maintain him well. So that's another place where, if it happened, I'd be very intrigued.
Yeah, I think of all the destinations we've discussed here in this conversation, I think I would leave him as a first rounder with all of them except San Francisco. I would honestly, even coming off that season, with that, depending on what else they did with their lineup, but with that home park, with that lineup around him, I would have trouble. And we're recognizing that there is still an injury history attached to Stanton. I would have trouble keeping him in the first round, I think, if he did end up with the Giants. But there's still a lot to be played out here, so we don't need to jump the gun on that yet. But that's kind of where my mind's at with him right now.
I think that makes a lot of sense. While we are speculating, let's speculate on Shohei Ohtani. I have a personal bias, maybe isn't the way to put this. I have a high level of skepticism about one particular thing as we come into discussing him. There's these questions that we have to answer, or we may have to answer at some point, about what do you do if this guy actually does pitch and hit. I am exceptionally skeptical that he will do enough of both to be really worth talking about. My personal hunch is that he is going to be a pitcher who might get an at-bat here and there, who might get a pinch hit at-bat here and there, who is going to be dangerous when he bats on the day he pitches. But I am extremely skeptical that he is going to be able to be both a major league pitcher and anything approaching a major league hitter. So first, because there are interesting questions about if that is the case, but first of all, are you with me on that, or do you have more optimism that he really could be the two-way star that it would be amazing that we all hope he can be?
So I'm with you as far as being skeptical that he can be a two-way star. As far as even looking at his numbers overseas, batting, they're good. They're not incredible. This isn't probably someone who's an elite major league hitter. And then at that point, if he is an elite pitcher, it seems foolish to have him risk injury by, even as a DH, by being in your lineup a lot when You could lose your ace pitcher at some point due to like a minor injury running the bases or something like that. So from that perspective, I wonder if this is really a long-term solution. But I will say this, there's going to be a very competitive market to sign him. And I'm wondering if an American League team will really will promise him, if right. this is what he wants, if he wants to pitch some days and DH some days, I'm wondering if an American League team will promise him that because they feel like they need to do that to be the team that gets him, and they know that maybe that's not their preferred scenario from the get-go, but they feel like they won't get him otherwise, and that may be a way for a team, maybe even a team that doesn't typically get players like this, it might be a way for a team to promise him what he wants and give him the money that he wants, and then that gets them out a little bit ahead of the pack if that's something he really wants. So if it is what he wants, I could maybe see an American League team giving it to him, at least at the start of his career, which then raises the troubling right. fantasy situation of someone being a pitcher some days and a full-time batter the other days.
So I think you do touch on a really key point as we wonder where Ohtani goes, and that is that the dollars aren't going to be that big a deal. And I think it's a really important thing to keep in mind, is that for a major league player, for you or me, the difference would be pretty enormous. For somebody who is almost certainly going to make the kind of money he's going to make in his career, the money up front is probably not what's going to determine this. It's going to be whatever the other things that are important to him. And I don't know that we know that, whether it's exposure, whether it's a chance to win, whether it's a chance to hit. But I think you hit on the key point there, which is, it's not going to be somebody blows everybody else away by $20 million just because of the rules. So it's going to be where this guy wants to play. So I do think that's a key thing to remember. I think you raise a good point. So let's take that. Let's play that out. Let's say that this guy is going to get opportunities to hit more than, 50 or 60 at-bats or whatever a starting pitcher gets. Let's say he's going to play at least somewhat regularly. What do you do as a commissioner, as somebody running a league? How do you handle what's basically an unprecedented situation? We've had Brooks Kieschnick and we've had these kind of guys, Owings, who do a little of both. We've never had anybody who is really worth having on your roster as both a hitter and a pitcher. So what do you do?
Yeah, I don't know if there's one right answer, really, but I see a couple possible scenarios and one that I think I like better than the other. So the first scenario I see is, and actually I think I'll give them both, and then I'd be interested, Matthew, in your perspective on which one you like better, and then I'll tell you which one I like better. So the first scenario is we have multi-position eligible players already, but typically that's confined to either hitting or pitching, but he would be multi-position eligible at pitcher and at utility or a position if he's fielding a position. And if it's a weekly lineup league, you get to pick each week whether you want to put him in your lineup as a pitcher or in a hitting position, but whatever you put him in, those are the stats that he can get you. He can't get you the other ones. They don't count. So if you put him in as your utility hitter and he pitches a no-hitter that week, you don't get it, those stats. And if it's a daily transaction league, that's a little sketchier because you can move him back and forth. It would make him quite valuable in those scenarios. But you could have him the days he pitches in your lineup as a pitcher, and the other days you could put him, if he's in the starting lineup, you could put him in at a hitting spot. So I think that's one option. He's one player with dual position eligibility. Like a lot of other players, it's just he has a really unique set of dual position eligibility. And then the other option that I have heard some people mention that is interesting is that he could be in your draft twice, once as a hitter and once as a pitcher. So one owner could draft him at some point in the draft as a pitcher, and he would be available to him with pitcher eligibility all season. And another owner could draft him as a hitter, and he would be available as a hitter to that owner. So he would be in two active lineups in different roles at the same time. Now, Matthew, can you think of another way to handle it, or is there one of those options that you think is a little more sensible than the other?
So I think there's a lot of pieces to unpack here. I think I like the second one more if he's in the American League. If in any given game you can be pretty confident that he is pitching or hitting, then I think that's a pretty clean and elegant solution. If it starts becoming more complicated in the National League where there are games where he is both, I think that's a little weirder, and even if it's not necessarily even if it's not necessarily a logistical problem, it just feels weird in a way that the other doesn't. To me, the problem with the first solution is going into this year, he is enough of an unknown that even if you get the value of both of those things, even if you can, even say it's a daily league and you get the full value of Ohtani as a pitcher and a hitter, he's enough of an unknown against major league competition that he doesn't blow up the whole draft. You're presumably setting a precedent, and I think that's one of the real keys here is whatever you do, you're setting a precedent. This is probably what your league's going to do next year. So let's say he comes out and he's not Max Scherzer, but he is Luis Severino good. He is a very, very good number one caliber fantasy starter. And let's say in addition to that, as a hitter, he's, I don't know, Andrew Benintendi without the steals. He's a 20 home run, guy who hits for average, not a superstar, but a very good offensive player. I don't think that's inconceivable. That guy blows up every draft. That guy is so far and ahead the number one player, especially in a daily draft, that it almost becomes unfair. And the whole idea of a snake draft, I mean, I guess in an auction draft, that's another matter, and that's fine. But in a conventional non-auction draft, I think you run the risk of one player just being so much more valuable than everybody else that I think that problem is the biggest one to me, and I think in the end I'm more willing to work out the logistics of the draft him twice. But you are way more in this industry than I am. This is more, this is something that you talk to people more than I do about, so I'm definitely curious as to what you think are the issues and which way you would lead.
Yeah, this is a good discussion then, because I think my preferred scenario is the first one where he can go in your hitting or pitching lineup, but I'm not completely, cemented on that idea. My concern is him, it's more if he's in the National League, although I guess it could happen in the American League, it's more likely to happen if he's in the National League, but my concern is him pitching on the same day, getting you the stats from his starting assignment as a pitcher, but also the stats as a hitter.
Sure.
Because if he can get you the stats if he can get you hitting stats on the days where he pitches, then why can't Madison Bumgarner get you hitting stats on the days where he pitches? I know Ohtani is like a novelty to us because he might start other games, but on the days he pitches, it doesn't really seem fair or sensible that he can get you hitting stats, but another pitcher who maybe is a decent hitter can't. And in a mixed league, the fact that these pitchers do some hitting on the days they start, that doesn't, it adds to their value, but it doesn't change a lot. But in an NL-only league, it actually might, because the worst hitters in some of those NL-only leagues aren't really doing a lot. And you may say, I'd rather just have Madison Bumgarner and take his stats on the days he pitches and get a couple homers. You may or may not, it depends what your lineup transactions are like, if they're daily or weekly, but that to me, it seems unfair that he would get stats from hitting on the days he pitches and other pitchers don't. So I don't mind that just him being one guy and you have to pick. So then on the days he pitches, obviously you wouldn't want him as a hitter because you'd rather get that starting assignment, assuming that he's a good pitcher. I'm also skeptical enough that he will be a really good major league hitter to believe that him, in a mixed league, him getting you production as a hitter isn't going to be that valuable. So it might be a nice novelty, and you might be able to plug him in your lineup. But when we look at all the hitters that will be on waivers in your league, for example, I don't think he's going to outperform them in most of the mixed leagues to such a great degree where he's a really valuable pitcher and he's a really valuable hitter. I could see him being a really valuable pitcher who has a little extra value because he's a hitter. But to be honest, I would probably rather have Max Scherzer, and I'll just figure out my last hitting spot with an actual position player.
I definitely do agree with that assessment. I mean, that's kind of what I said at the start. I am skeptical that he is going to be an impact major league hitter. I just think you kind of have to be prepared for it.
Mm-hmm.
But look, I think that, and maybe this is something for the real dark of winter, I have long thought that fantasy should account somehow for pitchers who can hit. And I don't know how, and it's probably a whole separate, entire other conversation, and I'm sure people have talked about it more extensively than I've thought about it. But I do think there should be some value in having a pitcher who can hit maybe in an NL only. But again, that's a whole other can of worms that perhaps we will examine sometime down the road.
Yeah, and I know what you mean. In NL-only league, that would be a really easy switch to make in league settings, and it could be made in a mixed league as well, and it's I guess it would be a bit of a detriment to NL pitchers if they're not good hitters to have them as part of your team if you have to count their hitting stats. At the same time, NL pitchers usually get a little bit of a bump because we talk about that all the time, that they get a little easier road, so it might be a bit of an equalizer. The important thing, I think, with this situation is that as soon as he signs, for people who are listening who are commissioners in their league, the pressure is now on to figure out something. I mean, at some of the big sites, maybe they'll just set it for you, but in a lot of local leagues, the pressure will be on the commissioner to figure out a fair way to do this that keeps the integrity of the league. And it's probably something where in a year it'll seem a lot clearer to us once we see his real skill set, but it is a decision that'll impact their 2018 leagues a lot.
I would think that might be the one recommendation I would make for people who are, and I just said that you're setting a precedent, but I think that, you know, there's probably something to be said that if you sort of run your league kind of independently, if you have a group of people that you play with and you kind of set your constitution, which I know is how a lot of people play, whatever rules you put in, there are things we probably aren't going to foresee, and you should probably be flexible. You probably should agree in advance that this rule that you're putting in is for this year, and you'll revisit it next year, because I strongly suspect that we can't foresee all the complications that are going to arise from this, and you probably shouldn't make yourself stuck with what turns out to be a bad rule that you can't foresee it being a bad rule.
Yeah, definitely. And in a non-keeper league, it wouldn't be the end of the world to just say, we're going to count him as a pitcher for his first year in the majors, and then we'll reevaluate it
sure,
in the league after the first year to see how much he's actually playing as a hitter and if it's worth us changing a rule for him or not.
I mean, honestly, there's a pretty compelling case that's the way that most leagues mm-hmm. should go. I think that there's a lot of sense there. Just make it easy on yourself, and then if it turns out that you need to make these adjustments, then you can make them next year. I think there's probably
and the headache in a keeper league for him is just too big to get around today because
yes.
when somebody picks him in that league, they're going to want to know that whatever rules are governing him will stay consistent, you know, for the time that they have him in multiple seasons.
All right. We don't have a whole lot of news right now, so let's do a little bit of looking back at guys who caught our eye last year and what do we think about them next year. First of all, and one of the big questions all over baseball, all over fantasy baseball for next year is you know, what does power look like in 2018? I don't think we know the answer to that. But out of Joey Gallo, Chris Davis, and J.D. Martinez, just strictly on power, because I think we all know who we probably like the most for overall value next year, but just purely on power, which of those guys do you like most for 40 home runs next year?
I would say I like Davis the most, but I would put, and I think this might surprise some people, Gallo second. Obviously, I like J.D. Martinez much more as a fantasy asset than either one of them. And Scott Boras may hate to hear me say this, but Martinez's power jump last year was really extreme, depending on where he signs. You know, he wasn't a 40-homer type guy before, whereas Gallo, this is kind of what we always expected Gallo to be, a 40-homer type player who doesn't hit for average, and Davis has now done it 2 years in a row. So I think I would rank them Davis, Gallo, Martinez. Are you of the same mindset? Or I think a lot of people would put Martinez higher than I have him for 40-homers.
No, if we're just talking power, I think that makes a lot of sense. And by the way, in case people are wondering, we are talking Chris with a K. Chris with a C is a whole separate issue. But yeah, I think the point you make is that, you know, Davis has done this 2 years in a row, and in fact, in some ways, had very similar seasons the last 2 years. The home run totals were almost identical. Batting average was identical. He walked a little more this past year and struck out a little more. But you know, this is kind of who he is, and we certainly think this is who Gallo is. But you know, Gallo. 204, 200, 209. Now, admittedly, that's a total of 150 plate appearances before last year. But, you know, he's a 201 big league hitter. And those guys are that's a really tough line to walk. It is really tough to hit 200 and stay in the lineup and stay productive, even if you have ridiculous power, even if you have an ability to take a walk. I worry more about Gallo having the kind of slump that harms his playing time and therefore harms those home run totals in a way that I don't for Davis, and I certainly don't for Martinez.
Yeah, I can definitely see that side of things. If Martinez ends up back in Arizona, I think now Gallo would go to the bottom of my list, but we'll have to wait and see how that plays out.
100 RBI guys from this past year, and boy, could you have won some bets getting even like three of these guys. Travis Shaw, Nomar Mazara, Nick Castellanos, Jonathan Scope, Jake Lamb. Who do you like the most to repeat that? Who do you like the least to repeat that?
Yeah, I think I like Scope the most. I think this may be somewhat of a level that he can sustain. He's got a lot of nice things around him as far as a nice park and a division where with a lot of offense typically. So I think Scope is the one that I like the most. As far as ones I like the least, I don't have a great faith in the rest of them to get 100 RBIs. I'd say I probably put Lamb second. The other ones I would probably even take the under on 90 RBIs, maybe even on 85. Castellanos, I worry a bit about the lineup that he's going to be in once Detroit gets to opening day. Mazara, I did some little deeper dive of statistics from last season with him, and he was really, really lucky and hit really well with runners in scoring position and then didn't the rest of the time, and that's unlikely to continue. And then Shaw really faded in the second half. So I would not only take the under on 100 runs for those three, but I would probably take the under on 85.
I like Lamb the most out of that group. He had 91 in 2016. He is in what should be a very good lineup again, even if Martinez leaves. He's in a very good ballpark to hit. He's been pretty steady. He is what he is. I love Scope the player. I love the power. I love the mild but still some development of his strike zone. I really love Jonathan Scope as a player, but I have some real concerns about, I know the division, I know the ballpark, I still have some concerns about what that Orioles offense is going to look like next year. They have not done a lot to get guys on base the past couple years. You know, they were a three true outcomes lineup a few years back. It was really down to two this past year. And I definitely have some worry about how many base runners there are going to be for him. So while I really like the player, I would be worried about him repeating the RBI total in a way that I wouldn't with Lamb. Let's do the same thing with stolen bases. I mean, none of these guys are that shocking, but all of these guys had 25 steals, and all of them are guys who are probably a little risky going into the next year. Cameron Maben, Rajay Davis, Delino DeShields, Jerod Dyson. Which of those guys would you, as of now, have some faith in for a 2018 source of steals and guy you'd be willing to keep on your roster in order to get those steals?
Yeah, DeShields would be my favorite one from that group. I see some on-base ability there, which I feel like Texas keeps kind of moving him in and out of those starting roles, but at least this year he was more in than out, so I'm hoping next year maybe we get to the point where he's finally in, and then maybe you could get even more than 30. I think it was 29 last year, so I think maybe you could even get 35 steals out of him. For the other three, Dyson, Maben, and Davis, we'll have to wait and see where they sign, and I think it would have to be, you know, a situation that's pretty advantageous for them for me to draft them in a 10-team league. I think, but with so few base stealers out there, in a 15-team league, you need to draft them, and even in a 12, maybe you have to consider them, but I'd say if I was going to rank the next two, it would probably be Dyson. Dyson seems to get his 25 to 35 steals every season, so he's probably next for me. And then Maben, and then Davis. Unless Maben gets into a full-time role, although we've talked a lot of times before that Maben, it always feels like just when he gets rolling, he ends up injured again.
I'm with you. I think DeShields is the guy from that group. I mean, he got 440 plate appearances last year, and he's still, again, we've talked about this before. I've talked about this before. It seems like he's been around forever, but he's only going into his age 25 season. I like him a good bit going in next year. I think he's an intriguing guy. Starting pitchers, Jason Vargas, Trevor Bauer, Drew Pomeranz, Zach Davies all had at least 17 wins. Let's start by saying don't chase wins, but out of those guys, who do you like for 18? Not only for wins, but just as a guy to have in your rotation.
Yeah, you're right. Don't chase wins. That being said, they will all get drafted probably in mixed leagues because someone will see those win totals and think, at least in the late rounds, I should at least give them a shot. In 10-team leagues, I would draft Bauer, Pomeranz, and Davies. I don't expect anything more out of Davies, but I think he can just be what he was last year, but with 12 wins. Pomeranz is probably the one I like the most. I think Pomerantz, when he's healthy, is a pretty good pitcher, even going back to things that he did in 2016 with San Diego. And then I would draft Bauer with the strikeouts. I think I like Bauer a little more than Davies and maybe a little less than Pomerantz. So if I was ranking them, it would be Pomerantz, Bauer, Davies. Vargas I wouldn't touch. I had Vargas in some of my teams in the first half of the season, but in the second half, he was really ineffective. We know what his velocity is like. I just don't see him getting back on track to the degree where he helps the mixed league team. I think this will just always be that. When we look back at his career, we'll say, oh, hey, remember how good he was in the first half of that one season, you know, and it'll be 2017, and he had a really nice run, but I don't see him ever getting back, not even to that point, but I don't see a sub-4 ERA or even a low-4 ERA for him next year.
I mean, to some extent, and I say this a lot, but it's because it's true a lot, when you get to the actual point of drafting these guys, to some extent, it's going to depend on what you need, because I think you hit on kind of a key point, which is Davies is a little more of a safe pick, whereas Pomerantz and Bauer are both a little riskier, but also really high upside, at least from start to start. I mean, Pomerantz and Bauer are both guys who, you know, if you told me right now either one of those guys is going to be American League Pitcher of the Month for May of 2018, I'd kind of nod and be like, yeah, I could see that. And so, you know, if you're in a position where what you need is that upside where maybe you didn't get that high one and you kind of had a safe one, a soft ace, and you're hoping that maybe somebody you draft a little later can boost you and get you some ace-like performances. To me, that's Bauer even a little ahead of Pomerantz. Pomerantz is a little safer, but again, with the health, with the sort of inconsistency sometimes within seasons, I still feel like he's a little bit of a risk. But those are the two guys on that list for me.
Mm-hmm.
Guys coming off bad seasons, including one I liked a lot. Rick Porcello, Matt Moore, Jeff Samardzija, all 15 losses and ERAs over 4.4. I'm not drafting any of those dudes in a mixed league next year unless it's 15. And then, I mean, I might take a late flyer on Porcello, but to me, I'm... In a mixed league, I don't see it with any of them. Are there any of those guys that you like late rounds of a mixed league draft?
Yeah, I actually do. I like Samardzija, and it's just to get everything else. So, I mean, his ERA was 4.42, but his FIP was 3.62. His WHIP was 1.14. So even last year where he hurt your ERA, he did help your WHIP, and he had 205 strikeouts. So, and the 15 losses, like I know we're not focusing on the losses, just
right.
A little bit of a sign that those pitchers didn't have a good season. I worry about run support with our Giants pitcher for next
year. He got losses in part because he pitched for a bad team, and
right. There's,
barring something shocking, it seems likely he's going to pitch for a bad team again in 2018.
That's right. So I'm going to pick him, hope I get 200 more strikeouts, and maybe 11 wins, and an ERA more around 4. So I would take Samardzija. I would be happy to have him. Porcello, I would consider with my last pick, just in the sense of, and I know he outperformed his skill set in 2016, but I would consider Porcello in the last round, throw him on my bench for the first two, three weeks of the season,
right. And
then probably dump him. But at least if he's off to a good start, then consider him. But I'm not fixated on getting him. And Moore, I think I've moved fully, and I know we said some positive things about him when he went to San Francisco, but with an expected weak lineup behind him and then his own struggles, I think I'm fully like I'll have to see it to believe it again. Really, when I look back, like there were high hopes from him in the beginning, but in the last three seasons he's been pretty consistently, you know, hurting
yeah. Your
ratios. So we've got to go way back. I mean, 2014 he barely pitched. Like we have to go way back to 2013 when he actually last helped
right. Your
ratios.
Right, before surgery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean that's really
right. That
simple. Since he yeah. Came back, he hasn't had an extended stretch where he was a guy you'd want on the roster. So that's
yeah, and he's always been someone who hurt your WHIP. Even when he was
yeah. Good,
he had
yes. Whips
around 1.30, so and
right. Sometimes
even a little higher than that. So even when he was good, he was getting you strikeouts and a low ERA, but he was hurting your WHIP. And now, so I mean, we can almost count on him to hurt your WHIP. That seems unlikely to turn around, and now the ERA is not as low, and the strikeouts aren't really there anymore.
And then we will close with closers, appropriately. All of these guys had 35 saves this past year. Alex Colomé, Greg Holland, Kenley Jansen, Corey Knebel, Roberto Osuna, and Fernando Rodney. Putting aside Jansen, who we had a conversation about a couple weeks ago, Who do you like most, and who scares you from that list? Well, you know what? We should probably throw out Rodney, too, because we both, by default, say that we don't. Rodney scares us. So who do you like aside from Jansen, and who scares you aside from Rodney?
Yeah, I think first thing about this list that interests me is that those are all of the closers who had more than 35 saves.
Yes.
So for how many times we project closers to have 40 saves, 38, 40, 45 saves in a season, last year, just, six guys who had more than 35 saves. So you should pretty much plan when you draft a closer next year that anything over 30, if you can get you 35 saves, that's great. And anything above that is icing on the cake. And because I think often when we draft closers, we expect 40, and that doesn't seem to be the case for closers really anymore. From those closers, Colomé, I think I trust. Osuna, I definitely trust. Greg Holland, not so much. And Knebel, I think I mostly trust, although there are still control issues there.
Yeah, Knebel's a really, like, he's such a high upside guy that even if I didn't fully trust him, I'd be willing to take the risk. You know, Osuna, I mean, when we've talked about Osuna before, what a weird year he had with so many blown saves and yet 83 strikeouts and 9 walks. But, you know, there is a little part of me that does wonder, you know, with the number of blown saves, does he come in the next year with a shorter leash, or is he absolutely the guy come hell or high water? And I don't know the answer to that. You may know that better than I do, but, you know, I trust the pitcher, but I only trust the role like 85, 90%, not 100%.
Yeah, I think his leash is long. I'm going to just trust his skills over, you know, over the blown saves this year. I mean, for someone who he's 3 full seasons in the majors, and the worst whip he's had is 0.93.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty remarkable. So I would worry more from the 10 blown saves. I would worry more about the effect maybe it could have on him mentally, as far as if he blew a few saves in April, could his confidence be rattled? And that would be my concern more. I do think he'll get a fairly long leash from the Blue Jays, especially. They have other pitchers in their bullpen who were fine last year, but not, unless they sign someone, not really a like definite, you know, next man up to be the closer.
And they have needs they have to address, so they're
yeah.
probably not going out and spending in the bullpen.
Mm-hmm.
All right, everybody, that's the Fantasy 411 for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, Fred Zinke, for taking the time to talk. Everybody, enjoy your Thanksgiving, and we will be back with you after that holiday.